Welcome to It's Who You Know, the podcast, bridging the gap between Jewish leaders and those who follow them. Gain insight from Jewish professionals who make the decisions that influence your Jewish world.
Welcome to It's Who You Know, the podcast. This is your host, Michelle W. Melkin. My guest today is Rabbi Paul Kipnis, who is a spiritual leader at Congregation Orami in Calabasas, California. I asked Rabbi Kipnis on the program today because I had the pleasure of working with him as a youth advisor many years ago, and I was very fortunate to have him officiate at my wedding. Those are more personal things. More professional things is that he has written a number of articles for E-Jewish Philanthropy about the changes that are happening within his congregation and the evolution in terms of programming and culture and the way that he's engaging his community. This is pretty much the exact thing that I'm searching for and looking for in terms of what is healthy and good and happening well in our community. So this is the one thing we'll focus on, although his book is amazing, and I'm sure we could talk about that. He took a technology sabbatical, which was also very awesome. So maybe we'll touch upon a few of those things, but really I want to touch upon the evolution in the series of articles he has put out about these changes. So first, I just want to hear all about him. So welcome, Rabbi Kipnis, to the program.
It's great to be here. It's great to be in conversation with you again. I miss our regular talks when we worked in the same building a couple of offices away.
Yeah, it was a good time. It was a good time. So how did you find yourself, you know, there in Calabasas all the way from Massachusetts, leading this congregation of yours?
I was in New York City in rabbinical school at Hebrew Union College, and I fell in love with a beautiful, bright redhead, Michelle November, now my wife. Decided to take some time to see how life was like out here. And in the meantime, got a master's degree in Jewish education at Rea Hirsch. Best thing I did in my whole rabbinic career, probably my whole professional life. Taught me how to think deeply and clearly. And after some time as a camp director and then a rabbi and educator at Beth Hillel, I found this little shtiebel of a place. It was 90 households. When I jumped over here, taking a major pay cut and major prestige cut. But I saw that this place was doing something amazing. And now, 21 years later, we're over 400 households, vibrant program, interns galore, transforming this place. And I'm having a lot of fun.
How do you fit 400 families in that little space? I'm sure it feels very homey.
You don't need a building. You need good community and good people.
Lesson number one, we'll write it down. So did you always want to be a rabbi? Was that always something that you felt a calling towards? And is that, do you feel like through or me in these last 21 years that you've actually actualized what that original intent was for your rabbinate, or has that evolved over time?
I was blessed to be in synagogues with vibrant rabbis. I grew up at Congregation Shalom in Chelmsford, Mass, where my folks were, I think, the seventh family. And by the time I left, it was 30 households. And then now it's about 60 plus, maybe even 100. And everybody just did. And it was the center of our lives. And we showed up and we learned and we played. And in my teen years in Worcester, Mass, with Rabbi Stanley Davids and Gary Glickstein at those synagogues, I found a calling and a purpose. There were people who took me seriously as a kid when I was going through the usual teenage adolescent challenges. And in Nifty, I found a place to develop leadership skills. Did I always want to be a rabbi? I always wanted to be part of the Jewish community. It gave me warmth, made me have purpose. Later, I realized, looking at all these young rabbis, that I could be like them. I took a little piece along the way when I was Trinity College, thought I was going to be a physics major. And I did probably 2 years of that. I loved the way I thought about the world, but I wasn't into the math as much. So changed over. Best
That's
decision.
Wonderful. Right, right. And do you feel like there, you know, I don't think every rabbi has the opportunity to really work so deeply in a camp in terms of directing that. Do you think that really influenced the way that you... Have you taken any of that experience into the way that you look at your work today?
Totally. The beautiful thing about Jewish summer camps is it's a total immersive experience, and it is totally positive.
Right.
It's not fetching. It's not putting people down. It's not critiquing. It's about looking at each individual, recognizing their B'Tselem Elohim in God's image, and lifting them up. This synagogue is based on that. When people walk in the door, they should feel overwhelmed by the love that's surrounding them. When they walk in the door, they should feel like they matter. It should be filled with beautiful music. It should be experimenting and innovative. But that's it's not just about Jewish summer camp. I also take inspiration from three other places: Starbucks, Disneyland, and, as you know, Netflix. Starbucks, mm-hmm. because in the early years, I don't go there as much anymore, but you walked in, you felt like you were in your living room. You could have a drink made the way you want it. People took you seriously. And used to love that. Disneyland, you walk in, and it's not just intellectual. It's an experience. It's totally immersive. And, of course, Netflix, because when things come their way that are challenging, they learn about it and just pivot and innovate. And that's what Ora Me, and I think synagogues in general, ought to be like.
Awesome. So what was your expectation when you came into this role initially with this small congregation, as you said, taking a pay cut, wasn't quite sure how it was going to work out. What changed in your thinking in terms of what you expected was going to happen and what actually ended up happening?
I came from a big synagogue where the budget of the youth department I ran was bigger than the whole budget of the congregation I was joining.
Oh my gosh.
And so I had to rejigger everything.
Well, I'm happy that you made a youth budget for me anytime and where I got there.
And boy, you took it and did incredible things with it and with the kids here. The thing that attracted me to this place was that people at the Oneg Shabbat schmoozed with each other. And when someone went to the table to get some food, another group would open up and sort of swallow them up and in. It was that social thing I learned at camp, where people are really interested in people. I had to learn in this place how to do things differently. We did not have a big staff. We didn't have a maintenance staff. To this day, we don't. Someone right. comes and cleans a couple of times a week, but that's it. And I had to quickly unlearn the things I did in these big congregations I was in, where they had all the staff. And I used to vacuum. I used to move chairs. I'm one of the few people who know how to set up all the chairs in the sanctuary.
Nice.
When we have a really big event, program, or service. And when we had chances of building up certain kinds of staff, we decided not to expand the staff that does the administrative work, if you will, rather program and what I call nefesh or caring compassionate staff, those we invest in. Because if everybody has to help set up chairs and everybody has to help stuff the mailings and everybody has to help figure out how to balance the budget, then we have some skin in the game and they show up.
Right. Wonderful. Well, then let's take it to your work. I mean, you've specifically what we're talking about, you've published, is it three articles on this?
A whole variety on particularly on teamwork and transforming our teen program and some of our high holiday services. But the most significant one is to date, for me, is the one about disruptive Judaism. Mm. Is your synagogue going to be Bait, Blockbuster, or Kehilat Netflix?
Yeah, I mean, and part of what brought you up for me was the popularity of that particular article. But it wasn't, you know, the first, you know, it wasn't the first time we'd heard about this. You know, you've published a few times about this transformation and the way that you and your staff approach these changes. So walk us through a little bit about how, like, what was the point that spark of saying, all right, we got to do something different. You know, what we've been doing isn't working. And that process of bringing about thinking about creating pushing through, making a reality, and then seeing if it's successful, right? Tell us a little bit about what this process was like for your community.
Sometimes I think I'm not really an original thinker. Rather, I listen to what other people say, and then I act on it, and I get other people to do the same. So in the article, the main article we wrote, but the other ones, basically every time we saw a challenge or heard about a challenge out in the world, that the Jewish world was talking about, we'd bring it back to the synagogue and talk about it and really quickly find a way to implement a solution to that problem. Years ago, the Union for Reform Judaism had a campaign for Jewish engagement, campaign for teen engagement.
Right.
And they had a big gathering at their biennial convention with big thinkers to talk about how we're going to better engage teens. We're losing them. Well, Rabbi Julia and I and a couple of lay people leaders went there, Rabbi Julia Weiss, came back and we said, next year we're blowing up our teen program. Let's just fix it.
Right.
And we started having all these meetings with all these teens and all these parents. And within 3 months, we had blown it up and had a new direction to go and implemented it. 3 months later, it was up and running. I believe that we live in a Jewish world where we schrei gewalt, we throw up our hands, the Jewish world is falling apart. Here are the problems, and everybody listens to it. And then synagogues particularly don't do anything.
Right.
I never wanted to be that. I want to do things. So we take these things, dues. People are saying that dues are out. People don't want to pay dues, especially millennials, but even before. They're too expensive, whatever. Everybody was throwing their arms up. I just picked up the phone, called Kerry Olitsky, who had written this book on synagogue dues, and got two people in our congregation, sat with all these business people and said, if we weren't doing dues, if there were no sacred cows, what would you do? And they came up with all these great ideas. And then we put together five people. A committee to transform shouldn't be 20 people.
Right.
They ended up with the lowest common denominator. And then you just go and do. And so they spent time studying and came up with a new idea. And it went through the board in two meetings, one to talk about it, one to do it. And we transformed it. And it was the best thing. We are up 28% in our we call it partnership, over 5 years, because we changed our whole structure.
Right. Well, there's lesson number two, just go and do, right? That's the article. Next article you write, just go and do.
Just go and do it. Try it. You might fail.
Right.
You know, I'm not afraid of failing.
So have you failed?
yes, but I'm trying to remember. Yeah, we've done lecture series that no one shows up for.
Right.
And we've had to cancel. We have, look, on a certain level, Triple T, our Transfer Temple Teens, our teen program, was a success in that it brought all these kids in, but it got tired because kids' focus changed.
Right.
And so we just blew it up again and created Hub 9 to 12 and Hub 7, 8.
Mm-hmm.
I've had great ideas for services and we put all this time and put money. Do it, go in, and it was a mistake.
Right.
And we all, different than other places I've been, we just look at each other, we laugh, we say, oh, well.
Right.
We talk about what did we learn, what didn't, and then we move on.
Right. So what do you think makes the difference between, you know, you talk about the room full of people talking about this thing, what do we do, and you going and doing. What is it that you think prevents others from going and doing? Is that fear of failure so prominent, or that fear of we're not going to make our budget, or we're going to lose the money, or we're going to, you know, lose our teens, or they're going to hate this, or our staff doesn't have the capacity to make those changes? I mean, all of the excuses I'm sure you can kind of come up with, but why? What's that barrier that you see with your colleagues that are struggling a little more to make these changes?
People in general don't like change.
Right.
Some do. I happen to get bored pretty easily, so I like
right.
change. But people don't like change, and institutions don't like change.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd rather stay in homeostasis and equilibrium. Well, you know what, if everybody's talking about the challenges, let's move forward and try the changes. The worst we can do is make a mistake. So what are the elements that move us forward? One is we build in a culture of caring. If everybody's getting their social personal needs met, or most of us, then we're more willing to try other things because we know we're still going to be cared for. A second thing is we're not afraid of the money issue. Money is the thing that so often keeps people from doing things. It's going to cost too much. Like kids with special needs, all these synagogues say, we can't do this. We can't figure out how to change it because, you know, we're going to have to pay for this, that, and the other. We just said, we don't have a lot of money, but your kid deserves to be in the synagogue and deserves to be learning. So we made a policy that said any child of a congregant has the right to a Jewish educational experience. And every child of a congregant who works to the best of his or her their ability has the right to become a bar bat mitzvah. We call it b'nei mitzvah now here at the synagogue. So what does that mean? It means that we start with the policy of we're going to do it. And then we figure out how. And we try things. And we tell people we're going to make a mistake, but we'll talk together and fix it. It's the can-do attitude. It's the recognition that if we want to survive for the long term, we need to try and innovate.
Right. Well, you just glossed over something that I want to go back to.
Please.
B'nai Mitzvah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was incorrect. We're starting to move towards calling it, I think, Beit Mitzvah.
Okay.
But we haven't determined a word. Some years ago, we had a wonderful young woman who was struggling. And 3 months before her bat mitzvah, she said, it's a bar mitzvah.
Right.
And I looked at the mom and the dad. I said, I'm totally there. Are you?
Yeah.
They said, this is our child. And so I helped them craft a letter with help from rabbinic colleagues. We have a great Facebook group. And crafted a letter and sent it out to all their guests explaining the change and hoping they'd come and celebrate with us. And it went off without a hitch. It was just a natural transition. Since then, LGBTQAII plus, or just queer. Everybody's, you know, somewhere on a spectrum of gender and sexuality. The synagogue world needs to just open our arms up and accept. Here's part of the thing. Who am I to judge your sexuality, your orientation, your gender? We're all created B'Tselem Elohim in God's image. So synagogues have to stop judging and start opening our arms and embracing. There are limits.
But that's, I mean, that's what it is. You have a bat mitzvah. You have a bar mitzvah. That's, I mean, I can't say that it's been a bat mitzvah for only so many years because it hasn't been for, you can't say it's been for hundreds of years. But, you know, we're working with a gendered language and it's, you've got to come up against some resistance to people who just don't understand, right? Who just don't understand why you would want to make this change and why you would want to make a somebody who identifies as a girl have a b'nai mitzvah or bas mitzvah or whatever else you want to call it and not a bar mitzvah because you decided that change needed to happen and made it.
So we've been teaching all these years in small ways and big ways about inclusion. We've been teaching that we were all created B'Tselem Elohim, high holiday sermons and teaching. We've been saying it means that to really accept people for who we are, we have to make ourselves a little uncomfortable. The laws that have been passed down to us, except for a few, were written by human beings, mostly men, in their own milieu, in their own world. They weren't given by God, and this will be uncomfortable for some of your listeners and offensive to others. But we don't believe, Reform Judaism particularly doesn't believe, and I bet conservative Judaism is moving there and Reconstruction already is, that we believe that they're at best inspired by God. but it's human beings who have to articulate them. So that means it's all open for us to look at and say, well, we need to make a turn because we kind of got it a little wrong. Or we understand things better. So we're teaching people when people are uncomfortable about the change, you know what and they write me fiery letters. I don't get a lot of them, but I get some. You know what I do? I don't email them back. I pick up the phone and call them and invite them for coffee or to my office, or I go meet them anywhere and we just talk. And usually it's lack of understanding. And sometimes it's values. And sometimes if the values are different, this may not be the community for them. And I'd love them and hook them up with a colleague who with a better community that means for them.
Right. And I mean, and you're lucky in some ways in terms of this change management that you experience and the fact that you are in a smaller community, you know, members, not members. You don't have, you know, a lot of staff that's been there for a long time, that's been doing something for a long time, that then you're presenting change, right? That's you have built in as a leader this sort of constant desire for change. And in your comparison between, you know, Blockbuster and Netflix, in terms of one that is constantly innovating, constantly changing, and one that was super happy, you know, renting out VHSs, and then, oh, wait, it's a DVD. Now we're going to rent out DVDs. And right then that's, by the time they tried to catch up, they couldn't. And there's a really great podcast called Business Wars that actually dove right into, you know, this whole saga of, you know, of how Netflix won and how Netflix is what it is today in our world. And that's hard. And so, you know, one of my questions in sort of the change management, a lot of times when I talk to organizations that are doing really awesome in the Jewish community, organizations in which there was a big change from a legacy organization to a more successful modern organization, there's always this great leader, right? There's always this person who's driving that engine. And you have said sort of for yourself that you're not an original thinker. It's not you, right? You're just taking other people's ideas, lifting other people up. But like, do you need that? Do you need somebody who's just going to say, sorry, this is what it is. It's now B'nai Mitzvah. That's what we're doing. Be angry. Cool. Or is it something else that needs to be the catalyst for moving these things forward?
It would be naive of me to say and think I rule by dictate. Everything goes by all sorts of people in conversations.
Right.
The president, the board, various stakeholders. We do a lot of listening. When we bring a change, we may do it really quickly, but we've had conversations on most important issues with a couple of hundred people, teens, adults, and whatever, one-on-ones and large ways. I don't think even a charismatic leader can make long-term, regular, multiple ones if the culture isn't transformed into a place open to innovation, open to risk, open to failure. Right. So once you embed that in, then the leader can say A, B, or C because the community is set up for it, but it's in conversation. I also want to be clear. I work in partnership with Rabbi Julia Weiss and Cantor Doug Kotler, and they are the other halves of my brain, thirds of my brain,
right?
I think. And we push each other and run ideas by each other and help each other keep moving forward. And when one of us says, well, we've done it, this is the way it should be, the other looks and says, why? But there's even something better. We have all these young interns from Hebrew Union College, Jewish Institute of Religion, some from the American Jewish University, AJU, and we even have a rabbinic student now from the Aleph program, who work with us. And my rule with them is they will have all my time, energy, attention. They can ask anything they want. They can sit in almost any meeting they want to, with one expectation in return. Two. One is, you know, we develop a level of trust in all areas except and loyalty in all areas except for harassment. If they ever think they're harassing me, I'm harassing them or whatever. You got to deal with that with right. other people right away. Okay. People who.
The good ground rules. That.
Right. But the second thing is I need you to hold up a mirror for me, to me, and make me look at things I'm not seeing. And so we have empowered all these young people, plus our faculty, plus our office staff. And in our staff meetings, one of the regular questions is, what are we not doing right? Or what's still a problem? And most of the time, they come up with the problems and they come up with the solutions. A good leader sits back, asks questions, sits back, and lets people think it through and come up with solutions.
Right. You mentioned when we first started talking, you know, about the warmth of the community and the feeling you want people to have walking in. And I'm curious, I mean, you just talked about it a little bit, and that's why I'm coming back to it in terms of how you manage your staff. And granted, you have a smaller staff and, you know, your relationship with Rabbi, I call him Rabbi Julia, you know, is more of a partnership than somebody who works for you, right? Than a director of education might be, or in a larger synagogue structure. But how do you foster this warmth within a staff, and how do you, and or would you, if you were in a different context, come to a conclusion that, hey, you know, this person is not open to change, is not open to innovation. In order to get there, we have to part ways, right? Or there has to be something else that happens, right? In terms of how, so it's a double-edged question, right? The first is, you know, fostering that sense you want for the whole community within your staff. And then how do you know when it's just not working out?
So you know who the most, my wife, Michelle November, is the director of admissions at DeToledo High School, the second largest Jewish high school in America. Mm-hmm. You know who the most important person in that whole institution is to me? Her assistant.
Right.
Office assistant. If that office assistant gets support and kindness from me, when I need to get to my wife, she'll make sure it happens.
Right.
Okay. Similarly, who are the most important people in this institution? I mean, everybody's important, but Susie Stark, who is the voice of Orami, sits at the front desk, is my right hand. Lizette, who's our bookkeeper, and Jenny, who's our registrar. I got to keep the others, the youth advisor. They have to be happy. Our staff meetings, part of it deals with the kindness and looking at our own lives. We often start with a question that has two answers. One answer is personal and one answer is professional. What are you most excited about right now? We share both in our personal lives and here at the work we're doing at Aura Me. What are the obstacles? You know, we connect it sometimes to the holidays or to various things. And we talk about that. So we're invested personally and we're invested professionally. You know, there's two kinds of supervision. There's supervision to improve, and there's supervision people often do toward evaluation and therefore to hire or fire. I think we should be spending more time mentoring our staff and supporting our staff. And so in addition to our regular meetings, we do a lot of talking by the by, walking around, whenever I have ideas, from what kind of new door should we put on the sanctuary to which logo are we going to choose to how do we build out the new hub program. The office staff, who arguably could be just in charge of data processing and answering phone calls and fulfilling other responsibilities, are integral to the process. And so they feel part of it. In addition, so most all of the big decisions, even the strategic plan where we're updating now, the first people to look at it, again, are our staff, which is our office staff and our program staff. Let them, who live in the synagogue, they know people more than me. The second thing is, what do you do when there's someone who doesn't get it? A lot of conversations, clear expectations, clear goals for growth.
Right.
And we have people who haven't made it, but I'm proud to say that except for maybe one or two, everybody leaves with a hug and comes back. The Jewish ones, most of them stay as part of our community. And the other ones, we connect up and have gatherings for holidays and stuff, and they come on by. Because when it's time for people to move on, if we both come to understand where the differences are, I want to help them get a job in another place that works for them.
Awesome. You know, when it comes to this, so kind of refocus back onto the article and these changes that you made, one of the things, I'm going to pull it up because I just love it, is this, the new program of Mentrify. And I loved when you were kind of talking about how that permeated into the kids and what those ideas are and how you're sort of looking at the DNA of what you're trying to communicate to the children in your community. And then how do we do that? So I want to hear a little bit about, like, what are you seeing as that need? Like, there was something that was happening in terms of a program. You noticed there was a need that wasn't being filled. You changed to fill that need. Like, what are our teens, what are our kids going through? What are they looking for in connection to a congregation, in connection to a religious school? Because I can't believe that it's only a B'nai Mitzvah. Like, if that is solely the only reason that somebody is coming to your congregation for religious education, you've got a really big problem, right? So what was that need that you saw, that you felt in creating something like Mentrify that touched that, where, yes, they might have a B'nai Mitzvah, but there's something deeper going on there. How did you get to that deeper something to pull out this Mentrify concept?
So what you're hinting at is we had a program called Mishpacha, a family alternative learning program. It was a family religious school in addition to our regular drop-off one. And it won national awards for innovation and family education. And for 10, 12 years, it was fantastic. But felt like something wasn't quite right. And so Rabbi Julia started to talk to her friends who had young kids and said to them, what are you looking for? And many of them said, we don't have a need to join a synagogue. We're not sure we're ready for religious school. But boy, we want our kids to have good values. Mm-hmm. What we realized they were talking about is they want their kids to be mentors. We then talked to people in the program and tried to figure out what they were liking about the program and what they wanted to change. And over the course of time, we asked them also, what were your best experiences with your kids? Mm. And people talked about mommy and me, daddy and me, parent and me. Those gatherings when the kids were little, when they would sit together on the floor and do activities and sing and have circle time at the beginning and closing circle at the end. And where they, as parents, were learning about how to be better parents because they had these little kids and they didn't know what to do with them. So we looked, Rabbi Julie and I looked at each other and said, what if we create a program that's just an older version of that same thing? Mentify is really a parenting program, a Jewish parenting program, with a youth learning program surrounding it, all sitting in a family program.
Right.
And people want their kids to be kind, compassionate people. We believe that Judaism provides a path to get there. So we took what people want. Isn't that the human-inspired design? I forget what it's called. Where we start with what they're looking for, talk about what we want to do, and find a way to marry the two together.
Right. It's a little different than design thinking, which is just trying to put your head in the mind of the consumer and their experience. But you're kind of taking the two different pieces of their experience and what they want and what you want.
And find a way to marry them together. Yeah. With the teens, we got a great grant from Federation, from their PK to 12 grants that allowed us to pursue an idea that we were thinking about, which is every kid who walks in the synagogue is carrying a backpack of stress and pressure that you and I and our parents never knew. These kids, look, most of them are comfortable economically or somewhere, but emotionally and spiritually, they are struggling. They feel pressures to perform. They're living in a world that's in a country that at this time is so coarse and unkind. They're feeling bullied. They look up on Facebook and or Instagram now and TikTok and Snapchat and realize they don't measure up to these other kids. Odds of these other kids. So we decided we were going to transfer. We were going to be a safe space for these kids, not just a name, but we're going to transfer perform everything. We ended up training the staff. The most important people in teens' lives at a synagogue are not the rabbis and not even the youth advisor. It's the school registrar and the bookkeeper who talk to the parents regularly, who can tell, if we train them, they can tell when things are going on at home. Mm-hmm. It's the security guard out front who sees the kid walk in, and if they notice that Johnny is moping a little bit or Sophie doesn't give him the high five as usual, those security guards now know who to tell so that we can check into it. And we all work together to help these kids. And we took away Torah learning time to be able to teach them stress management techniques that they can do at home to fill a toolbox, if you will.
But then they're not learning Torah. Then what's the point?
Torah, you know, when Rabbi Hillel was going to the bathhouse to wash, someone said, "What are you doing?" He says, "I'm going to do a mitzvah." They said, "What's the mitzvah?" He says, "I'm keeping God's, the gift of God, clean and healthy." When we teach them how to care for themselves and how to get through the stresses, we are doing God's work. Isn't that what Torah is about? And then they're able to listen when we talk about large issues, whether it is Jewish values in public policy or intermarriage or love or the Parashat of Shavua or any of that.
Right.
No one can listen if they're in pain.
Right. And that's very special to be able to be in tune to that and have that community. So is that Starbucks? Is that Disneyland? That's Starbucks.
That's Starbucks. You walk in and you're seen and you're accepted for who you are.
And it feels like home, right?
Darn right. In fact, our new logo is Congregation Or Ami, your home. Y-O-U apostrophe R-E, home. So it's you are home or it's your home. Mm-hmm. People will come to Shul if they feel like it's home, their second home.
Right. And this is the first time you changed your logo since you started, right?
Actually, no. We changed it once before.
Okay.
But this was a major one. And how did we do it? We had two people who were in the graphics business, four people in the graphics business. They went, talked to all sorts of people to figure out how they described Or Ami. And everybody kept coming back to one word, home. And then they did it.
That's beautiful. That's great. Yeah, it's beautiful.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting too, because I always think about the divergence of change in terms of, change for change's sake and change that, is necessary and how much change can a community handle, right? Is it that the program changes every 3 years or 4 years or 5 years or, how often is it important to stop and pause and have that evaluation? Or is it important to have change for change's sake just to have something new and interesting to engage for your community to engage with? Or do people get fatigued and they're like, oh, what new thing is it now? Like, we just got used to XY program or XY of doing things or some expectation I have when I walk into this building. Or when you set up the expectation that change is just a natural part of how we do things, then it doesn't matter how much change you sort of throw at people. They're welcome to it as long as it's, a good change, which hopefully, as you said, sometimes it's not. And sometimes you find out, okay, no, never mind, step back. We're not going to do this. We're going to do something else. But there's kind of that balance between, changing often enough to remain relevant and changing too often that it never feels comfortable. It never feels like home. The stability isn't there, right?
Absolutely. And Blockbuster knew they had a really good thing and knew they had it all together. And there were 10,000 Blockbusters all over the world. And everybody knew what it was and loved it. And they're gone.
Right.
And there's like, someone said there's one left in Alaska or something.
Yeah.
Human beings change all the time. We don't think we do. But I remember walking a couple of years back by the mirror in my bathroom as I was going to get something. And I looked in and I looked at that face, and the beard that used to be mostly black was black and white. I had changed and I didn't recognize myself, because inside I felt the same.
Right.
Well, human beings are always changing. If we can recognize that, then we see that change isn't bad. We innovate. We don't innovate for innovation's sake. We innovate because we're taking the old wine and just putting it in new bottles. Hmm. We're taking the same teachings of Judaism, but using new ways of doing it. Our kids grabbed onto Facebook way back when, so we adults had to do it. They jumped into Instagram, so we adults have to, and synagogues have to do it. Now I'm trying to figure out TikTok and how to use it in a synagogue, because kids use it all the time, and Snapchat.
Right.
Change for change's sake is not a value, but a recognition that humans are always changing, and so institutions need to hold on to our core values. But among them should be to change the way we deliver the same message.
Mm-hmm.
I think that gets to it more.
Right.
Yeah.
There's a very interesting, real quick, a Hidden Brain episode. I was asking, it was about a study that they were asking participants, you know, how much have you changed in the last 10 years? Like, oh my gosh, I'm a completely different person. I've changed so much. And then, you know, how much are you going to change in the next 10 years? Like, oh, I'm totally set in my ways. I'm not going to change at all. What are you talking about? You know, and this perception of, you know, the present of who you are and how things are and where things are going to go versus where things have been, that you can't see in the future, to know that, oh, in 10 years, I'm going to be a completely different person than I am today, because 10 years ago, I was a completely different person than I am today. But that's hard to see from a current, you know, perspective.
You know, the Instagram thing, where you're supposed to post.
I don't know any Instagram things. Talking to the wrong person, but yeah, sure.
Other things where you post a picture of yourself today and one from 10 years ago.
Okay.
The decade difference, and you see that difference. The Union for Reformed Judaism 10, 15 years ago did a survey of congregations to see what makes for a successful congregation, synagogue. And they came up with all sorts of things. But the top two things, number two was that the clergy feel safe and secure. When the clergy feel safe and secure and taken care of, the synagogue is soaring. Because if you feel like people are coming at you all the time, you can't do your best work.
Mm-hmm.
But the number one thing that made for synagogues that were growing and vibrant was there was a sense of excitement. New things, exciting things going. Brotherhoods and sisterhoods, not all of them, but become ossified because the old people stay in the people stay in the same roles, and they can't move aside to let young people come in and create new roles for them. At Congregation Orami, you can only chair a committee for 2 years, even if you're the best at it.
Right.
Okay, because we need new ideas coming in, and we have to make sure we don't ossify. And it's painful to ask people now to step onto something else. Of course, in the end, they become better leaders because they've been doing all sorts of, different parts of the congregation. Institutions get so caught up in doing it the same way, we kill ourselves.
Yeah.
You know what the best part of Netflix growth for me was? When they realized that their success was based on being able to provide you, the viewer, with great recommendations, they weren't sure that their algorithm was right. So what did they do? They took the code for their algorithm, put it out into the cyberspace world, and said, come up with something better for us.
Mm-hmm.
They opened up proprietary algorithm, and what came back was better.
Yeah.
And they keep tweaking it. Synagogues need to do that. Tell me how to do what I'm doing better.
Well, that's what you're doing, right? You're taking the things that are working for you. You're taking the process as well. It's not just like, you know, you made these changes and then you put in an article. We made this great change. You know, you've taken us on the journey with you through kind of talking about these various steps that you've taken in enacting these changes, which I think is, you know, extremely helpful in understanding your process. And for better or worse, you know, not every community has Rabbi Paul Kipnis, and not every community is as, you know, nimble and has that same culture, right? To then go and say, okay, we've had the same VP in their VP slot for 10 years, and now I have to go tell everybody or try to make the change that it's 2 years, right? You know, that's, you know, coming up against that and against the institution you're in is sometimes difficult. So in all the things that we've talked about, thinking about those that are working maybe in more, not calcified, what word am I looking for? Stuck places.
Yeah.
You know, what advice do you have for them? They hear these awesome things, and I hear this from everybody all the time. They hear this great podcast, they hear this great idea, this great program, but like, that's where it ends, right? It's too hard, it's too much, it's, you're coming up against culture and personalities and whatever. So what's the advice? And on all ends, right? Some people maybe are in a culture like yours where they can make, you know, awesome changes, and you know, their opinions are valid, and they're running with stuff and able to fail. So just any kind of, you know, you've given so much advice already, but other types of advice, anything you haven't already really mentioned for people in the field who love the Jewish community, work for the Jewish community, care about the Jewish community, but, you know, might find themselves a little stuck.
It all begins by asking questions and listening. If I had a new idea or a thing that I saw didn't quite work, I'd begin by asking a whole bunch of people in the institution and those who don't come to the institution how they feel about XYZ. It's the principles of community organizing, because it gets people to think and recognize they're being heard. If we do that enough, we create a culture of asking questions and of listening. So that would be one of the first things I do. A second thing is recognize that not all institutions will be able to do this.
Mm-hmm.
Not every synagogue and not every Jewish institution has the right to exist anymore. Some have become so ossified in the way of learning, of looking, of being, that they're just not going to be able to make the change. You know, as a rabbi, I spend some time with people, and sometimes there's nothing else the doctors can do. And the most humane thing we can do is connect people up with hospice and love them as they move on to the next journey.
Mm-hmm.
But then every so often you see these places and you see something that's pregnant with possibility, and our job is to help midwife them through.
Mm.
And how do you do that? You do a lot of learning. You bring in experts, both those high paid ones who can do it and other colleagues and people who can say what you want to say, but they can do it a little differently. And it's not like the family saying it. It's someone outside saying, what you have is great, but how about this?
Give me a little more on that, because I, you know, as somebody who, I don't know how to describe myself in this way, I don't want to say like takes on too much or is too bullheaded for things, but I always want to be the one that, you know, brings this learning activity to the staff or helps the staff, you know, do this thing. And, you know, I was told in my last position, you can't be a wise person in your own house. And that me trying to do these things for the staff wasn't beneficial, because I was separating myself from them in being the one leading that activity. At what point do you need that outside person to give that perspective in terms of, you know, I'm just going to play this podcast with Rabbi Paul Kipnis, and he'll tell, you know, this expert will tell us all everything we need to know about how to make change. But how do you feel that out as advice for people in the field when you're like, yes, I can push this through, and, or no, I really need somebody else who's not me, who's not on the inside, to come in and make my ideas a reality, because people will respond to them if they're not coming for me.
Okay. So I want to differentiate myself from you and from some others. I am a male and I am an older male. And so whether I get credit for my ideas or not plays out differently.
Right.
Because men get credit for their own ideas and for other people's ideas, and often take credit for women's ideas.
Right.
Women less so. So I want to couch what I say in that. It's one of the terrible things in all communities, in the Jewish communities, that we don't listen to women's ideas and give them the status and the pay and pay equity because of their women. and we have to change that. I think we have more power when we say, yes, what he just said, what she just said, what they just said. People have an easier time listening to people from outside who are called experts. So bring in another woman in the field who has this idea. Let her share it out. And then the leader gets to say, this is why I brought in this leader. Because she's helping us see something that sometimes we're too close to. I think she's really onto something. You get the kudos for bringing in the person. But the person presents the idea. And if you've done it right, you've met with that expert beforehand and laid out the concerns, the problems, right, and made sure you're on the same page.
Right. So for everyone out there who's looking to make change, you know, sometimes it is a little easier to bring in that outside person. Because I even, you know, I don't know when I'm going to publish this, but I'll say this anyway. I talked with Dan and Lex from the Judaism Unbound podcast, and it was awesome. And they were telling me, you know, people come up to them and they're like, oh, I love your podcast. These ideas are so great, but meh, you know, like, I can't really do anything because, you know, everything we just mentioned. Right. And so it makes me think for that person, you know, how, you know, we just need like these professional change makers that you can hire to take the ideas you want to do and present them as, you know, from the outside as best recommendations and see it through, which is hard to say that in our Jewish community, that's a route you need to take for that. And I don't know if in my experience, it feels like change and innovation are accelerating in our community in terms of we're going towards a positive direction of. And I do, I can say that. I feel like, you know, our institutions are getting more innovative. They're understanding the needs of, you know, communities. Different ones are popping up, I feel like, all the time that are serving those needs. But we still have things like synagogues that, as a structure of a Jewish community center, right, with spiritual aspects, they're just not quite bridging that gap between, you know, where you guys are and where, you know, maybe even your old congregation is. I don't know their deal. But those that are struggling, and I'm very lucky as an executive director for our synagogue, we're not struggling. We're, you know, doing really great. But in order to do really great, there had to be change, right? We got a new rabbi. We got me. We're doing a new logo. Like, we're so far on the foundation of change that I want to blow it all up and do awesome. But that's not easy.
We have to recognize that sometimes a strategic refiguring in the right areas can help change the whole piece.
Right.
Okay, there's a video game where, you know, you have this knocking ball and you have to figure out how high on the building to put it into the right, into the left. And if you swing it at the right time, the right speed, the right way, and hit one block, the whole thing will come down and then you can rebuild. But if you do it at another place, it doesn't make that much of a dent.
Right.
So we have to be strategic. Rabbi Julia Weiss is one of the most strategic thinkers I know. She's really good at it. She's a great planner. She's a ready, aim, aim, shoot.
Yeah.
I'm a ready, shoot, aim.
Right.
And together it's a great work partnership.
Yeah.
You can't blow everything up.
Right.
You were the one who said people need stability. They need to know they have a place to go that remembers them the anchor. So we work on little piece, but keep the other thing together. Then we work on little piece, other thing together, and keep going. And over time, we've built all this. All the things you read in that article and other ones were slow going.
Right.
And over the course, they add up to major changes.
Right. Right. And, you know, it's one thing that I had mentioned, like, my conversation with Dan and Lex as well, is just, you know, I've not had necessarily the easiest career path in terms of wanting to be an agent for change within the Jewish community and, you know, coming up against not change. But I also feel like there's a generation of leaders my age that are ready and primed to to push that through, and people in your position that are open and willing to bring that in. So I think there's a lot of hope for those, you know, those professionals that might feel right now suppressed, if you will, that like, keep trying, like, don't get discouraged. Like, you'll get there. And when you do, you'll have, you know, a lot of the knowledge and foundation to hit that brick, or to identify those bricks to start hitting, that can start to kind of rebuild what we, or not even rebuild, but to build something new, to create something new that serves the needs of the community, so that the DNA of what Judaism is that influences our lives so positively can continue in a positive way. So with that same thread, I know you have three wonderful children, of whom I miss very much, and a lovely wife, and, you know, your work here, and, you know, your involvement with HUC and mentoring, you know, new students every year, your blogs, you wrote a book. Any other books in the works?
I'm working on two. I have a project, Midrashic Monologues, with an F.com, with Rabbi Rachel Berman, a fabulous thinker and writer on the East Coast. And they're modern Midrashim, first-person perspectives on what's happening in the Torah. That one day will be a book. And I'm in the year of mourning for my dad, who died in August, Ken Kipnis.
That's right.
And I've been writing a lot of poetry to help think about and understand the process of mourning. And I think that will end up being a book too.
Awesome. So how do you do it? How do you keep it all together? What are, you know, I read that you do some yoga, you take walks, you know, you try to enjoy nature, and lucky you can do that year round when it's not on fire. But you know, what tools do you implement that keep you, you balanced and family time and you time and being able to do the work that you do?
First of all, I happen to be married to a woman who's not only lovely and beautiful, but bright, brilliant, and insightful. And Michelle is my Ezer Kenegdo, my opposite and my partner, and helps me think things through. But I also recognize she can't be the be-all and end-all. Right. I also have a great therapist.
Awesome.
And I think all rabbis, all clergy people, and probably all people these days who are working in big institutions probably should have either a therapist or a coach who can help us see on the larger end. Because when I come up against a wall and I don't understand why, sometimes it's the wall and sometimes it's the way I'm trying to get through that wall. And that's not something I should go through. I should probably go around it,
right?
Because that's the immovable part. I also writing for me is where I take dictation from my heart and my mind. Sometimes I don't know what I'm saying until it spews out, not even on the paper. I write almost everything I do on an iPhone with my thumbs,
right?
Usually at 5 o'clock in the morning or at 11 o'clock at night. And also, you know, I exercise 4 times a week. I walk on a treadmill, listen to music, and I'll be honest, I got lost in myself after the shooting at the Borderline Bar. After Pittsburgh, but a week later there was one nearby us. And then we had those
fires. I grew
up
in Thousand Oaks and would go to that bar
12
quite
people
frequently.
Killed.
Yeah,
gun violence is out of control, and we have to do something about it. Don't stand idly by. But after that and after the fires, I got lost. We were out of our building for a month, and I was helping lead the Jewish community through.
Right.
And I got lost in the hero complex. And then I got lost in an imposter syndrome. And most leaders go through that, even us old veteran ones and even the younger ones.
Right.
And it's good to have people beyond friends, coaches, therapists, whatever, to be able to talk it through.
Yeah. Mentors are really important. That's awesome.
Yeah, mentor.
Great. So anything else in everything we've kind of touched upon, you know, your work, change management, anything else you want to sort of touch upon as we wrap up our conversation?
When people wake up in the morning and take their shower, or at night they take their shower, they get out, they towel dry, and most people, most days of the week, stop and they're naked standing before a mirror and they look and they say, oh, I like that, I don't like that. We may not articulate it, but everybody's judging themselves and judging ourselves in our most vulnerable way. And the ones who make it through are the ones who say, okay, I can work on this and I can work on that. I can't work on this and I can't work on that. And I don't want to work on this or that. Mm. And then you find a way to adjust. Institutions, synagogues, schools, camps, Jewish institutions ought to do the same. I'm not advocating that people get naked. That's what gets everybody in trouble. But I am suggesting that everything should be open to look at and discuss, not all at once.
Right.
There are some things we can't handle. But no institution has a right to exist. We only have a right to try. And so every excuse in the book is there. But push through it and we can do it. The last thing I'll tell you is this. The most fun I'm having right now is this project called Midrashic Monologues, working with Rabbi Rachel Bierman. I look at Torah and we're supposed to put ourselves in it, but it uses a language that's ancient. And even when I study it, and with Midrash, it gets exciting. But what we're doing is trying to put ourselves in the heads of these people. Imagine, we just wrote one. What did Rebecca and Isaac really see in each other? Wouldn't you love to hear the first person love story, not in the ancient tunes? So we are having a blast trying to give voice using a modern perspective to ancient situations and see how we might bring out the challenges. And you're right. That's what synagogues have to do. We have to get out of our own heads and our old ancient ways of doing stuff and our institutions too and our Jewish organizations. And we have to get into the minds of where people really are. And then we'll find that the same Jewish values and teachings have meaning, but we have to do them differently.
It's awesome. And in that empathy, right? You're feeling the empathy of that character, the empathy of that story, of trying to look at it from a different perspective. And when you deal with change, you're dealing with people, right? Institutions are just people. And to just say, oh, this person's being so difficult and they won't make me change, you know, it's an iceberg, right? There's so much more under there that we can only surmise in that empathy when we're trying to do this work. And you're doing that with, you know, Torah and these characters and creating empathy of what must your life have been like, right? There's only so much we all know about each other when we work together to really look at, like, what do I not know about you? What empathy am I having? And how do I figure that out enough to help guide you in this change I'm trying to make as a team, which, you know, seems to be how you work with your team is as their leader, but, you know, their partner in creating these new innovative programs that speak to your community. Well, Rabbi, it was lovely to see you, lovely to speak with you. I really appreciate you sharing your experience and what you're doing in your community and your perspective with anyone who wants to listen. So thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure. Been a pleasure.
Like this episode? Have a comment or a great suggestion for our next interview? Contact us through our website at itswhoyouknowthepodcast.com or on the It's Who You Know Facebook page. As always, subscribe, rate, and review this podcast so that others can find us. It's Who You Know, the podcast.